Welcome back. It is now hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the Fukushima irradiated island chained nation in the sunny slave South Pacific, where it's so bright and sunny that everybody has a part-time job as an energy saver light bulb because there's just that much mercury in our tuna as well. And my very special guest, who measures the mercury, the temperature of the mind, and the structure and the flow of the universe, bro, is Dr. Bob Melamede. Welcome back.
Howdy.
Okay, so he's got his cell phone on his chest. That'll be good for your EMF frequency generation, and also the laptop. Now, did you know, Bob, that if you put a laptop on your lap, after about 30 minutes, over half of your sperm will die and the other half won't be able to swim?
Well, that's why I take cannabinoids to help protect my body.
Does it actually have that real effect? Like, have we done tests in order to, say, protect people from radiation? Because I mentioned Fukushima just before, for example. Now, yeah. I do know that that cannabis plants do tend to suck up the radiation from soil and contaminated lands. However, what does it do with that radiation once it's sucked it up into the plant? Does it just remain in the plant forever, or has it got a way of getting rid of it?
That allows you to reclaim the land, and then you got to deal with the radiation that's in the plants. But you could extract that then and then concentrate it. So rather than having a contaminated land, you've got a little jar of radioactive poison.
I suppose that's probably a lot easier, you know.
You know, it's healthier. It'd be better to not have the problem in the first place.
Well, yeah, I think that would probably be an idea. Which reminds me, I saw a documentary the other day talking about, I think it might have been some socialist or whatever, talking about how people, you know, unfairly demonize nuclear power and how it's really safe and everything like that. And even if it was really safe, every single nuclear power plant in the world is built on an earthquake fault line, okay? So no matter how safe it is, any earthquake at any time could potentially destroy, like, the whole world. How is that safe? What kind of reasoning process is going on in the minds of these people who promote nuclear energy?
Sure. The reasoning goes in their pocketbooks.
Uh-huh. What's the point? Okay, I don't know about you. In fact, I do know about you because you're the same as me. The point of being alive is to improve life, both for yourself and for those around you. If you ain't doing that, then you're not here for any good, decent purpose. Right? How exactly can we reconcile this? Because I watched this video this morning, Bob, of Luke Rutkowski from wearechange.org talking about how to deal with really depressing, negative BS that we're confronted with all of the time. And I wanted to know what your method is. Or is it just simply having a joint?
Well, again, it's a matter of taking in information and what do you do with it, you know, and what are you doing with yourself to try and minimize that which you don't like getting in the first place. You know, it's part of these feedback loops again. It's, again, natural collection of molecules cooperating with one another at this higher level of our consciousness and the society that we create. You got to either learn to be participant and have some kind of a vision as to what a positive change would be, or you just, you know, the sheeple floating along in the crap of the so-called leaders.
Is it simply down to that? Having optimism and kind of hope for the future, having a positive outlook, is that what will stop negativity from kind of taking root? Like, There's a war going to happen in Syria. There's mandatory government vaccination programs. There's 7 billion hollow point rounds being ordered by the Department of Defense, enough for 4 bullets per man, woman, and child in the U.S. These are all facts, right? Yet, if you've got a positive outlook, it doesn't matter how discouraging or terrifying the facts are, because you're capable of transmuting them and making something better happen, aren't you? Oh, his phone's gone down. So, Bob, if you just...
I lost you on Skype.
Oh, you lost me on Skype?
I lost you on the phone. Can you hear me?
Yeah. I can hear you. All right. So, what I was saying there is that despite... You can't hear me? Turn your volume up. Turn your volume up there, and that should work. Can you hear me now? No. AFR, could you reconnect Bob on the Skype, please? And we'll see if we can get him back up again that way.
Okay.
Having some. Yeah. I can hear you speak. I can hear you. You. Me? No. It's very difficult to communicate. Okay.
Call me.
Well, call me. Just start speaking. Go on. No? Hanging up. What's going on here? Okay. Sorry about this, ladies and gentlemen.
It's a major okay. I can hear you now over Skype.
Okay.
Whew.
Yeah, I had Skype calls and then phone calls. Somebody keeps trying to get a hold of me. One of the people that I work with.
Please turn your speakers down, though, because there's a bit of feedback.
Hang on. How's that?
Testing.
Can you hear still me okay now?
I can still hear you, but it's just that I can also hear myself talking back to myself across the feedback line. And we still have somebody trying to call you. That's probably American Freedom Radio trying to call you. Did they
draw? Do you want me to be on the phone again?
Yeah. You know.
Okay.
If that works. But you have to mute your Skype mic, of course, once you answer the phone. Mate, ladies and gentlemen, I seriously apologize for this. This has been what's the word? It rhymes with Usterpluck. an on-air Usterpluck. Like a duck. Bob, can you hear me?
I can hear you, sir. Yes, indeed.
You're loud and clear, but you're not on camera no more. You've got it pointed away from you. That's fine. All right, here we go. So my point was, we're dealing with negativity, right? All this negative stuff comes at you. You know, there's bullets being ordered by the government. There's tyrannical legislation. There's wars. There's famine. There's vaccines. There's viruses. There's such and such. Blah blah blah. Yet, if you've got a positive outlook and if you have a vision for the future that actually involves something good happening and not giving into the darkness, not giving into the evil, not giving into the bad news, you're actually capable, therefore, of transmuting all of that negativity into something good. And I'm not talking about just some kind of ethereal, airy-fairy type of stuff. You can actually turn bad news into good news with your mind, with your outlook, with your actions. And I think that the blips have figured this out, and they're trying to prevent the flips from figuring it out, that you can literally change human destiny with your own actions. And I think that's why a lot of people are really negative and depressed all the time, is because they've forgotten how innately, incredibly powerful they can be.
I would largely agree with that.
How exactly can we reconcile this? How exactly can we change this? Just in terms of a mental state of view, in terms of thinking, what would you advise people who are upset, afraid, scared of all this news and everything and all this fear porn that's being thrown at them day to day? How can you help people in their mode of thinking?
Well, really reflecting is, again, a lack of sufficient cannabinoid activity to deal with those stress levels. So they can try taking essential fatty acids, in particular omega-3, long chain, like fish oil or krill oil. And the reason those are so important is that's how your body makes its pot. Your endocannabinoids are made out of essential fatty acids, both omega-6s and omega-3s. And the fish oil is good in that it has the long chain omega-3s that your endocannabinoid system uses to make themselves, basically. So that's one thing you can do. And I've seen behavioral changes resulting from that. You know, one of my sons has a tendency to get overly angry at times. And he doesn't do that when he has his oil. And when we forget for a while, those are always the times that it winds up happening. You know, so at this point, we, I think, all pretty much firmly believe that there's that connection, and it does make sense as well, scientifically and, you know, observationally. So,
incidentally, hemp seed is high in those omegas, isn't it?
Hemp seed has a good ratio of 6 to 3, 3 to 6s. You don't want too many 6s because they have the ability to go down a biochemical pathway that could be inflammatory. And in general, most of the better things in terms of health-related are when you shift that thermostat a little bit towards anti-inflammatory. You got to appreciate how we got here, you know. 150 years ago, we were dying at 40 years old on the average, or 50 at the latest, you know. And we were dying from infections. And in general, the way we protect ourselves and the way most organisms protect themselves from infection is by making inflammatory biochemical responses as part of our immune response. So there's a balance. Everything, again, from the physics, everything is in balance. So inflammation is in balance with turning it off. So you have a thermostat
thing again. Is that why politicians are prone to giving inflammatory remarks?
Well, they're fighting each other. You know, the two sides of the aisle are always fighting each other. But by doing so, they sustain each other. So what I'm talking about is shifting that set point on a immunological level. Because today, now that we are eating better than we did 150 years ago, we have a less stressful life in many respects because we have, you know, gas heat, or you don't have to go chop your wood, and you have a diversity of food all year round, and we have antibiotics, which are good drugs, you know. So today we're living longer, and the main cause of death today is not infection in westernized societies, but rather age-related illnesses. And all the age-related illnesses, meaning autoimmune, cognitive dysfunction, cardiovascular problems, bone issues, and cancers, they all have a free radical association with their etiology. And your cannabinoid system is what minimizes that free radical production. So it inhibits all of those features, so to speak, that are characteristic of aging, which is why it's an anti-aging drug. And, you know, that you can see that in the sense that if you eliminate the gene, again, that CB1 receptor, those mice die prematurely. And they're super fearful. You know, they don't want to move around because just moving is too stressful. You know, they're the ultimate blip. So we need more cannabinoid activity in the human population, and that's what's happening right now with the movement moving forward as more and more people understand the health benefits, both from a preventive as well as a treatment point of view.
So, when we talk about this kind of development of humanity, going from being closed off, greedy, and negative, and depressing, we're talking about being more open, we're talking about being happier, and we're talking about being more creative. So open mind, creative potential, fueled by high energy, happiness, right? Is that essentially the main hallmarks of a non-cannabinoid deficient person?
Yeah, you know, and from the population point of view, we need to adjust the thermostat so that, you know, we don't want to increase our infection rate, but on the other hand, right now we're dying from age-related illnesses. Let's just, you know, tone that down a little. That's why people take antioxidants. That's why we exercise. Exercise moves you further from equilibrium. It goes back to the physics again. You know, when you're healthy, you're further from equilibrium. As you age and decline, you get closer to equilibrium, and death is a phase change that represents your loss of flow-dependent organization.
Mm. Can I make a couple of points, though? You raised a point earlier that people were dying earlier and that kind of thing. Did you get that information by chance from the law of averages, like the averaged out deaths? Because I heard that was a myth. Because what happens is there was a very high mortality rate as infants, but in terms of people living longer and everything like that, it wasn't terribly similar from 70 to 80 years old or significantly different from our average life today, except we're far more likely to survive today. And the law on averages is that you had a pretty high chance of infant mortality, so it skewed the figures to make it look like everybody was dying at 40 when it was the people who died.
Well,
died
it may early. Not have been that. It may not have, in reality, been like the straight average would suggest because of what you indicated, the high rate of infant mortality. That's true, but keep in mind also that the United States has one of the much higher rates of infant mortality. And if you look at, the average age, survival rate, it's been increasing. And if you look at areas of the world that in many respects might be more analogous to the United States 200 years ago, you see that they have those problems. Because without sanitation, for example, you're going to come down with more illness. It's common sense.
The other element is age-related illnesses. Some have said that they're in fact simply accumulative toxins, and it's not so much age-related illnesses that are killing people. In fact, I think one of the number one killers in America is like obesity, heart disease. You have a look at the typical American diet, the amount of pesticides, herbicides, goodness what other asides that are put into the food that's being eaten, the fluoride and the cancer-causing properties of that within the water. And before you know it, you got a 1 in 3 cancer rate. You got everybody starting to get arthritis. You got autism levels spiking off the charts. And it seems to me that health is starting to be greatly affected by the gradual and, I believe, deliberate accumulation of toxins in the American food, water, and air supply.
Well, toxins, are again our contact with our environment. And again, it's our environment that sustains us. So when you take in things that are toxins, you're not doing the correct thing. Remember, I talked about modifying the lens of your mind. If the lens of your mind doesn't know and understand these basic principles, of which nutrition is one, then you go down the wrong road. And especially if you're indoctrinated.
That's a good point. Hold on. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Dr. Bob. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 5 days a week, Monday through Friday in the US of SA. And if I do that in a Mexican accent, actually, there's quite a lot of immigration going on there illegal in the US, SA. And in New Zealand, it's Tuesday through Saturday, 10 a.m. till midday. And in about a month's time, time zone changes, with the old daylight savings and what have you. Summer's on its way. That's so good. I hate the cold. I hate the cold very, very much. A lot of people say that, you're in New Zealand, you don't know what cold is. I lived in Minnesota for such and blah, blah. Dude, you have not lived in Dunedin, okay? You have not seen your olive oil freeze at room temperature, okay? I don't care what you've seen. You have not seen that. And until the inside is 5 degrees colder than the outside, on average, you don't know what real cold is. That's what I'm talking about. No insulation, no nothing, huddling next to a dryer for the winter because it's the only thing in the house that's freaking warm. That's what I'm talking about when I talk about cold. Speaking of cold, we're going to warm things up a little bit. And we're talking about some lighthearted, happy things because what I've found is really great about being a creative, intelligent person is that you learn how to create ways to amuse yourself even when things just really aren't that funny. Stoner comedy. I was just yesterday, I was thinking about the genius of Cheech and Chong. Do you agree, Bob?
Yeah, I do.
Hey, man, am I driving okay?
I think we're parked, man.
You know, and this is what I think is starting to actually become a lot more prominent now in the entertainment industry and television shows and a lot of films that I've been watching. Is it was actually quite rare in films in the past, I've found, to see people, you know, just whipping out, smoking a joint or whatever, and now it's becoming a lot more common. It's starting to feed more into the mass culture, the mass consciousness. Have you noticed the same phenomenon?
Oh, yeah, certainly. Things are loosening up. I've been following this for many decades.
Well, what was it like back in the day versus what it's like today? I mean, from your perspective over time.
Well, I remember back in the 60s, we could smoke pot in a lot of restaurants and movie theaters in New York. You weren't harassed. That was before Nazi Rudy Giuliani and Bloomberg.
Yeah. Well, go on.
No, things are changing. And I used to talk about it quite a long time ago. The medical marijuana reality has to drive this because as stupid as we are, collectively, we will not, you know, cut off our heads despite our body. Because that's the magnitude of what we've done by preventing this medicine and this nutritional value as antioxidants, as age-preventing properties. It's insane. I mean, it's in mother's milk. This is one of my favorite stories. It's in mother's milk, psychoactive cannabinoids. Not the same chemical structure as THC, but the endocannabinoids that we produce that regulate things like how happy or sad we are, you know, how high or unhigh we are, right? And they're in mother's milk. So the first thing a mother does is she gives, you know, a smart mother does, is she gives her kids some cannabis boost. You know, the kid has just gone through childbirth all that time in the canal there, getting squished around while his head is crunched. And then it comes out and it breathes oxygen at a much higher level than it was exposed to in utero via the placenta. And pure oxygen is toxic. You know, years ago, they tried to treat premature babies with pure oxygen and made them blind. So thankfully, they don't do that anymore. But and then it also stimulates the appetite of the newborn, so the kid bonds with the mother. So what I believe is a distinct possibility, I think this is a very interesting hypothesis, is that the blips are people who were not nursed as children, so that they're still suffering from post-birth traumatic stress disorder. You know, because they lack that comfort and binding and neuroprotective properties that had elicited stress responses within them. And they become epigenetic, so that it's conceivable that not only those people, but their children. You know, it's like Cheney and his daughter.
I scarcely want to think of that image. And think about childbirth today has been made almost artificially traumatic too, hasn't it? You're born into fluorescent light, which is overload for new eyes. You have a person in a very scary mask looking down at you. You're not being held to somebody's skin upon first contact, say with your mother. You're wrapped up bundled up like in a cocoon of all these blankets to protect and you and everything that, like that.
You know, and if you're conscious enough, you can request that. And they put the baby on you. Yes, before they even cut the umbilical cord.
Yeah, key word there, if.
Doctor, it's not the standard always.
Yeah, well, just hear me out. Then after that, you get vaccinated, so you're getting jabbed with a needle. So your first experience is extremely bright lights, scary guy in a mask, can't move, and getting jabbed with a needle. All right? That's got to cause some long-lasting trauma for those that it actually happens to. Wouldn't you think?
Well, that's why they need the cannabinoids all the more that are in mother's milk.
Hmm. I once met a friend of mine who's from Ngāruawhia, and it's a place famous in New Zealand, you know, the word Ngāruawhia. Kind of is synonymous with a smoking culture, and he used to joke that as soon as you get born, you get given a beer in one hand and a joint in the other, and then you go home to your parents. And this is the strange culture that I think we've all grown up with now, is that it's from cradle to grave, essentially. You've got so many deliberate influences in your life that aren't positive. And unless you're conscious that this is going on, you can't escape them because you're not even aware that they're affecting you, right?
Yep. Well, that's why cannabis promotes self-awareness. And that's why it's been so dangerous to the establishment and the blips, because it does promote change. And it typically, I believe, has a greater probability of promoting intelligent change rather than stupid change. Now, there was a time when aggression and dominance was good, because you had a tribal, you know, society, and you had to have some level of organization and control. So there was times, you know, as man evolved, where having organizational power through control actually benefited man's, you know, societal evolution. But now we've passed that point. There are too many people. We produce and utilize too many resources, so that the only thing that's going to allow for long-term survival is to come up with appropriate means of sustainability. You know, I mean, we can pray, so to say, for miracles down the road that would give us unlimited energy sources and blah, 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 blah. But dealing with what we have right now, you know, we have to wisen up a little bit and be a little more conscious as to what we're doing and how we're poisoning the planet and destroying the environment that is necessary for sustaining our very existence.
Here's a question for you. How can we deal with where we are right now if we have no idea where we are or who we are?
Well, you can have the idea by understanding the physics of life of what you are. And by understanding what you are, and then you plug into that, you know, the specifics of the of your life's experience, that's what would shape the possibility of what you can become. When you integrate how you've gotten where you are and then through awareness gain an extra level of flexibility in your mind, then you can rechannel and set up your thinking for the future. You know, we do things that make us unhappy. You can't dwell on the unhappiness of the present. What you have to do is plan to minimize that occurrence in the future. And by minimize, I don't mean necessarily the phenomena itself, but your response to it. Because, you know, for any circumstance, you can respond in so many different ways. Are there ways that are consistent with it being less stressful and more healthy? And will they automatically be apparent to us once we understand better the nature of our being?
A very important thought here, but I've forgotten what it was. You know how interesting and annoying that can be. You have this set goal in mind. You know, in life, everybody's got these set goals, and you make those set goals based upon what your environment is. You know, what you've been brought up to believe. You know, you've been brought up in a seminary or something like that. Your goal is to sexually abuse young boys in a choir. Let's say you're brought up in the Rothschild family or the Rockefeller family or something of that nature. You don't feel like you had to earn anything. You know, you were born into it, right? How much life experience do these people who have these set paths laid out by, say, parents or whatever, and actually have a lot of control over their own life? Now, can we, as a society, even figure out ways to raise children to be their own person, or will they always generally draw their traits and their abilities from their genes and how they're raised, kind of thing? Or is it possible to change things altogether?
Well, I mean, in the ideal circumstance, what the parents would do, and I've got three sets of children, what the parents would do would be provide the child with the developmental environment that they would have the security and the knowledge of fluidity, and so that they had the direction and an understanding in a general sense, and then they would just explore that and fit it to their own specifics. That's empowering them.
So it's about kind of what, challenging children and giving them rewards from an early on? I mean, there's lots of positive lessons you can instill, and I found that the easiest way to teach somebody a positive lesson is provide a positive example.
Absolutely.
And they tend to copy what they see.
Absolutely. You know, if you got a bunch of drunken parents that sit around being drunk, that's a different situation than if you had parents who might be like my kids. They know what I do. I'm fighting for us to have the rights as human beings to use this plant as a medicine, because everything I understand about science tells me it's good. And I have an obligation to myself, my family and friends and society to try to become part of that, manifest that.
Why do you feel that obligation? What actually obliges you?
I think because it seems that a natural trait among people is that I believe, just because it's true on a molecular level, cooperation is our natural way. But because of fear and insecurity, we're in a mode where we have, again, changed the thermostat so that there's a higher level of cooperativity. It's the cooperativity on a molecular level that allowed for the initiation and continued progression of complexity manifest in evolution and everything that evolution manifests, you know, in terms of humans with society, et cetera. So we're part of that. There's no way to get around that. And what we can do is to try and understand, again, what we are, so that our decision-making process is going to be consistent, again, with us surviving and thriving. It's a really good movie, Thrive Something, I just saw the other day.
Yeah, I had Foster Gamble on the show. We had a right hot time. It was a fun interview. Good guy.
Yeah, that was very, very impressive. But anyway, you know, I think
that's actually kind of a good example. You take Foster Gamble, and you have a look at the environment that he was raised into, you know, all this wealth and that kind of thing. And yet now towards the later part of his life, he's devoting himself to the thing called the Thrive Movement for the benefit of all of humanity. So it's kind of an interesting case study that sort of proves the point. That it matters not how you're raised, it matters not the gifts or endowments you're given. You can make good out of anything if you choose to.
If you're lucky enough to choose, because what is there really such a thing as free choice or not?
Maybe not if you're fatalistic. I believe that there's free choice is a depressing thought. Ergo, I choose to not believe in it.
So I don't particularly believe in free choice. I think we're all part of our individual, unique unfolding, and that of the choices, with quotes around them, that we might have before us at any one instance, there are certain ones that are going to be consistent with our biochemical unfolding, and others that are inconsistent. And we'll, you know, it's a probabilistic thing depending on how we're feeling that day or whatever. It's all just part of this chemistry, this flowing chemistry. We are, in many respects, just a delusion.
Well, and indeed, that might be what's probabilistic, but I prefer to look at, as we said earlier, what's possible rather than just what's probable. Because what's probable can often be quite negative, and what's possible, infinitely positive. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com with Dr. Bob Moore. I'm back. As Jimi Hendrix said, there must be some kind of way out of here, said the flips to the blips. And my very special guest, Bob Malamede, has... I just want to say thanks, Bob, because, frankly, I had like four or five guest possibilities for today. you weren't even one of the possibilities, and then you turned up when everybody else cancelled out. And that was just great. Because we wanted to do a roundtable with yourself, Rick Simpson, Ian Jacklin, who's making a documentary about cancer cures, and Danny Panzella, who's also a prominent cannabis activist and filmmaker, I think, in his own right. And what would be good, and I wanted to get your perspective on this in terms of the blips and flips and blah, 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 is to get a whole bunch of people of like mind round together, open minds that are like-minded. Is that a contradiction in terms, or is that just how things really, really get expanded on much more rapidly? Can you hear me, Bob?
Yeah, I can. I didn't know you were waiting. Open-minded is the paradigm. The specific examples are, you know, unique to the individuals. So everybody is different, as we discussed with, you know, mice in a cage or different biochemically. So it's a matter of selecting for positive interactions and moving forward in a positive direction, you know?
Mm. Now, you were talking about how you're not sure if there's such a thing as free choice or free will.
Exactly.
You ever had a reptilian brain response? You know, when you get really angry at somebody when they say something to you and you yell something out of them or whatever, and you get uber Angus, you know, kind of like beef. And, you know that if you'd taken a few deep breaths and counted to 10, you wouldn't have said the same thing, you know? You can choose not to react like that.
Well,
and everything that you do is.
Are you doing the only thing that your biochemistry would let you do?
Mm.
There's no way of discerning that.
Learning, on the other hand, like, for example, if you do have those responses and then you go to an anger management clauses and it shows you what the warning signs are and so on and so forth, then you learn to behave differently. Learned behavior, I think, is one of the primary functions of free will, because if you know how to control your will through learning, it becomes a freer will, does it not?
I think that knowing that you have no free will gets you closer to having any.
How is that? Could you define it?
Well, because if I'm right and we're all just a probabilistic unfolding, and the key there is probabilistic as opposed to mechanical, you know, because of the nature of the physics of flow-dependent structures, there's always a probabilistic component to the way things occur. And different people with different genetics and different biochemistry will have a different repertoire of possibilities at any one time. And, so, you know, we can't really know if we've ever made a choice or if that was the only choice we could have made.
But it must be a possibility. It must be a possibility then, because if we can't decide that it's certainly not, then it's probable that it might be. Or possible, rather. And I remember this, we said this on another show. I don't think it was with you, it was with somebody else. But in a probabilistic reality, anything is possible. In a cannibalistic reality, anyone is edible.
I've heard that. but see, everything isn't possible. The possibility of you turning into a beautiful woman overnight is not going to happen.
What about with surgery?
That's still a different phenomenon. You know, there are.
I've got the cheekbones for it, darling.
You know, you could go and have the surgery. That's among the possible options. The chances of it happening independent of anything, you're just waking up one day and looking in the mirror and going, wow, that's not very likely to occur.
Yeah, I mean, despite what Freaky Friday movies will tell you. The other element here is it's kind of like we talked about positivity. Does not believing that there's such a thing as free choice, is that a positive notion or a negative notion, or is it neither?
I would tend to think it's neither, because it might be nothing more than what's real, in which case you know, the best, the better we can participate in some positive sense with the creative force that it made us, that's kind of like, you know, essentially following the will of God, so to speak. You know, we have this process that has gotten us here, and there are some people who are going to fight it, and there are going to be some people who are going to take it, you know, take it to a new level, and some people will just float along. You always have to have a variety of possibilities at any one moment, and then, you know, ideally, cooperative, positive ones are the ones that emerge. In the long term, I believe they do.
Indeed, it's quite possible for that to happen. And I was just thinking, you know, as we look back at, say, the Foster Gamble example, somebody could have been born and most predominantly their set path might not have been particularly positive, yet they made a choice and changed that reality. Now, if that's possible, despite all the odds, like you take me, for example, criminal convictions, father wasn't there for a large portion of my life, no inheritance to speak of, emotional trauma, a paranoid fear of being employed, and so on and so forth. You know, I've got all this bad stuff that has happened to me, and yet I believe it is, as you mentioned before, kind of like the will of God for me to get over all of that and do something positive with my life. Now, is that the divine speaking? In your assumption, what is the divine? I mean, is it like, you know, in Star Wars, how they said the midichlorians, these microscopic organisms that reside in all living things that continuously tell us the will of the Force? Is that actually what the endocannabinoids are? Are they the little things that are telling us the will of the divine?
In a sense, they are, because the more in harmony you are and the more fluid you are, that is the nature of divinity, from what I believe, because then you're able to participate better in the unfolding, which is, you know, your place in time and space, your karma. We're all in, you know, we all emerge from different histories. And, you know, that's just the way things are. Some of us are going to be more in tune in one way or another than others in one way or another. We're all unique entities exploring what can best fit with the future. Mm. And again, I always said it's time to replace blips with blips as leaders.
I was thinking the other day that if you want to be fatalistic about things, you know, like say, oh, it was meant to happen, or that was my destiny, or that was my fate, you can't say it beforehand, can you? You can't say it's my destiny or my fate to be the CEO of McDonald's Corporation, or my destiny or my fate to be American Idol. Once you are American Idol, once you are the CEO of McDonald's, then you go, well, I guess it was my fate, or I guess it was my destiny. When I think in having a belief in what your fate and your destiny is, instead of just reinventing yourself really on a day-to-day basis as things come at you, the only way it can ever possibly be accurate is through retrospect. Ergo, the eternal now is what's really important for you to focus your energy on, not your fate or your destiny, which is far off.
No, I agree with you. You know, what you're saying is right, because the only thing that's real is now.
Everything else is just, I don't know, ghosts in the mist.
It's a memory or a projection, but in either case, you know, how different is a memory from a projection?
Depends how much cannabis you've had, I guess.
Pardon me?
Depends how much cannabis you've ingested.
Yeah, that has a definite effect on those attitudes and directions, for sure. But the fact is that ever since the endocannabinoid system with respect to receptors evolved, the biochemical complexity of the successive phyla of organisms until we got up to humans here, it's always played an increasing role in our brain and, in fact, in the higher centers of our brain. So the thing that's so mind-blowing, and hopefully it's being taught finally in some of our professional organizations like med school, is that our endocannabinoid receptor system in our brain is the most abundant receptor system in our brain. Imagine that. And we've outlawed our personal right to turn it off or turn it on, depending on what our needs might be and what options we might have. It's criminal insanity.
That's like outlawing food being consumed through the mouth.
I didn't hear all of that.
I said that's like outlawing all food that can be consumed orally.
It is, because it's really the way it winds up regulating energy. And remember, it's the flow of energy through mass that organizes mass. So by regulating the flow of energy and free radical production in us, the cannabinoid system has a very extremely central role in our very being. And, you know, some people need to turn it up more. Some people might need to turn aspects of it down more. You know, and we should have the right. It's such a basic human right. To deny us that is just fascist Nazi crap.
You know what? I'm going to go to a protest this Sunday, and we're protesting for a number of different issues. It's the first combined protest where, you know, all the fluoride activists, people who are anti-government surveillance, anti-government tyranny, and people who are anti-cannabis prohibition, and so on and so forth and everything. And I reckon that'd be a good sign to have, Bob. Weed, it's a human right. Weed, it brings people together. Weed, yeah. It should be legalized. Thank you, Bob, for all that you do. Your wisdom and your knowledge in this particular instance, and cannabisscience.com, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah, cannabisscience.com, ladies and gentlemen. We will see you again sometime. Don't you go anywhere.